28%?
That's right.
Was that sort of him saying, well, let's compromise? Or do you know the logic of that?
I mean, perhaps. We'd like to obviously to go as close back up to 35% as possible. Corporations seem to still be pretty profitable with a 35% tax rate, but we need to take steps to raise it, absolutely.
Anything else you want to add?
I think that the big thing, and so just to say, we did this report with the Institute for Policy Studies, and we used data from one of our partners from ITEP and the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. And, I think what this shows is that, we need to have more policies so that the corporate America is paying their fair share in taxes. And, we shouldn't have big, wealthy, profitable corporations paying their executives more than they're paying in taxes.
Yeah, I wonder if anyone will propose a law banning or putting a limit on how much executives can be paid, not 300 times as much, maybe just 10 times as much. I guess that would be too, in the corporate world, that would be considered outrageous.
It is certainly something that we need to make sure that corporations are paying their fair share. There's certainly a lot of ways to do that.
That was David Kass of Americans for Tax Fairness speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Birdie. Thanks for being with us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right, 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. Right now, during the last week of our spring membership drive, your support can go even further. Contribute today at bit.ly/KBOO, and your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $20,000 thanks to the generous support of a group of anonymous donors. Maximize the impact of your support for KBOO right now and help us reach our $60,000 goal by May 25th. Thanks so much.
Plugged In on KBOO is a radio show dedicated to underground electronic music. The show is hosted by DJ Tronic and features deep house, tech house, techno, drum and bass, breakbeats, future bass, downtempo, and more. Plugged In frequently has local producers and DJs on the show, and we provide info about upcoming events in Portland, including free ticket giveaways. Plugged In airs the first and third Friday of every month from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Pacific time.
Support for TransPositive comes from KBOO members and RelationshipGardening.com, specializing in support and repair for couples. Virtual for Oregon and California. Information at couplescoach@gmail.com.
There's something missing and I'm litting. I got something to say.
Good evening, you're listening to TransPositive here on KBOO Community Radio. Tonight we are going to be talking with Mickey Gillette, who is producing Blonde on a Bum Trip at the Fuse Theater. It's going to be at Reed College, and the dates are May 16th to June 9th. Mickey, welcome to Transpositive.
Thanks, Emma. It's great to be back on again.
Thanks. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. My name is Mickey Gillette. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I'm the playwright of Blonde on a Bum Trip, like you said. This is a play about the three trans femmes who were involved in the Andy Warhol factory scene, Candy Darlene, Jackie Woodlawn, Hollywood Lawn, and Jackie Curtis.
Thanks. And we have another guest here with us tonight. Can you introduce her, please?
Oh, sure. Yeah, this is Ruby Welch, a talented actress who's playing Candy Darling.
Thanks, Ruby. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, it's nice to be here. This is my second play with Mickey. I'm one member of five in the cast, and we're excited to open next week.
Great, thank you. And joining us by phone is co-host Sheila. Sheila, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Sheila, and I'm very fascinated by what I'm hearing here, because I'm a Candy Darling fan from way back.
So, Mickey, this is your fifth or sixth play, isn't it? How many have you done now here in Portland?
This is the fifth production. So, yeah, it's exciting to get my work in front of people, and I'm grateful that there are people who want to produce it, like the Fuse Theater Ensemble.
That's so cool. Yeah, and you were recently listed as one of the 25 most influential artists here in the Portland metro area by the Willamette Week.
Yeah, that was a really great honor. I was really happy to be chosen for that list.
Oh, great. So you're transgender?
Yeah, I'm a trans woman. I started my transition in late 2010 here in Portland.
Great. And you're also a playwright. You've been writing for a long time.
Yeah. It's something that I studied in college and then afterward. And then I found that when I started my transition, that really kind of unblocked my creativity. So it's been exciting to get to write a lot and get to share it with audiences here.
And you've written several plays. I remember you did American Girl. That was one of your most recent productions. How did that go?
That's a very heavy play. It was about based on a true story of Nikki Kuhnhausen, who's a trans teen who was killed in a hate crime in Vancouver in 2019. So it felt very powerful to get to share, but it was kind of a somber experience. It was voted best play in the Broadway World Portland Awards last year, so that was a nice honor and kind of a validation for Nikki's memory.
Yeah, such a wonderful way to remember her. And this is your most recent piece now. I really want to spend most of the show today talking about the play.
Yeah.
And I want to talk to you and hear what you have to say. But first, I just kind of like to get a sense of like what led to writing this story about Hollywood Lawn, Candy Darling, and Jackie Curtis. It's a real different take for you.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot of stuff comes from my memory or my imagination, I guess. And this is about other people's lives. It's I've been fascinated by Candy Darling since the first time I saw her when I was maybe 18 or 19. I don't know if it was like a documentary or in a book, but I grew up in a time where there wasn't really trans representation and you couldn't see reflections of yourself in the media. And she wasn't just trans. She was this really glamorous person who was a part of this countercultural scene that was just seemed so kind of vibrant and cool. and it was this, I felt like she was this aspirational person. And as I got older, I would keep circling back to learn more about her and the people around her. And so it was always a source of fascination. And at a certain point, I felt like it was time to really dive into research and try to see if I could make a play out of their stories.
Mm-hmm. And each one is, so Hollywood Lawn, Candy Darling, and Jackie Curtis. So they're all it's like three different people. Yeah. Which one are you playing? I can't remember.
I'm playing Candy.
Oh, you're playing Candy. Oh, wow. Okay. So, Ruby, why were you motivated to try out for the part of Candy Darling? What appeals to you about that character?
I had a remote kind of idea about who she was, but when you learn that she like achieved a certain amount of local fame in New York, and her memory is infused with this like hunger for more, it's kind of a bittersweet memory that she didn't get to like live out her career.
Oh, okay, great. Well, let's talk for a minute first just about who each of these three people is then, so that our listeners who may not know who Candy Darling, Hollywood Lawn, and Jackie Curtis are will know a little bit more about their story. Why don't you start, Ruby, by first telling me a little bit about who was Candy Darling?
Candy Darling was a trans femme, trans woman who lived in New York City. She was born in like 1946. And so she was coming up into the like underground New York drag scene, the Greenwich Village, in about the late 60s. And at one point she kind of got into a play that got in front of Andy Warhol, and he put her into a few of his films.
Great. And but she didn't live, you mentioned that in just
I did
a minute, yeah.
I did. So
how did your life go after that?
In the mid-70s, just as she was experiencing a little more international success, she was diagnosed with stomach cancer. And she died pretty quickly. Hmm. And so this story is about these two other trans people that were around her, and their relationship as they kind of struggled to get in front of audiences and ride on the curtails of Andy Warhol. Yeah.
Thanks. And Mickey, can you tell me more about the characters of Jackie Curtis and Hollywood Lawn?
Mm-hmm. Jackie Curtis was... the terminology people use then isn't the same as what we use now, but I think we would call, maybe refer to Jackie as like non-binary or gender fluid. The people around Jackie used he or she pronouns kind of interchangeably, and it didn't seem to bother Jackie very much. And sometimes Jackie said that James Dean's spirit lived inside her, which is kind of interesting. And sometimes she would show up like Jackie, like James Dean, and other times in a more femme persona. She was a playwright, so she had plays produced in kind of the underground scene in New York. She was a great actress. You can find footage of her on stage, and she's really electrifying, just a really commanding performer. And she was in two films that a Warhol associate, Paul Morrissey, directed, Flesh and Women in Revolt. Very ambitious person, had a real drug addiction issues that caused her to die, not as soon as Candy did, but not very long after. And then Hollywood Lawn was a friend of Candy's who didn't seem to have the same drive that her two friends had, but was a really great performer. There's a movie, Trash, that she's in, but the other two aren't. And she's really fun. She's kind of the star of that. And a Hollywood director, George Cukor, started a writing campaign for her to win Best Supporting Actress at the time, which was kind of cool. They're all really sort of fun people, but they don't, like, the kind of success they had didn't translate in any way to financial security. So they lived very kind of tenuous lives. Like, they often didn't have places to live, were sort of scrounging for money, would do sex work. There were just a lot of drugs in that scene at that time that probably maybe precluded them making the most sensible choices for their lives. And they were all pretty young too. So Holly's the one who lived the longest, and she wrote a memoir in the 90s called A Low Life in High Heels, which is a really fun title. And it's fun to see her look back on it. But yeah, those are kind of nice little thumbnail sketches of the three.
Thank you. Sheila, you know a lot about this time period. Do you have any questions or comments you'd like to make? Go ahead.
I'm so delighted by this topic because I did a year of research to write my own Candy Darling. I wrote the play and it still exists, but I basically put it on the back burner for a while, and that's where it's remained ever since. But that particular year, I was fascinated by the whole Warhol scene. And what's interesting is that when Holly's autobiography came out, I was in touch with her publisher in New York, and so he gave me her number, and I got to talk to Holly Woodlawn, which was really cool. I didn't get to talk for a real long time because I never called her back, but I wanted to kind of get a kind of the backstory on Candy, because each of these very talented people had a radically different story. Candy was the beauty. She looked exactly like Sharon Tate and was just exquisite, and Holly was like this ball of energy. She was just bouncing off the walls all the time, and the genius was Jackie Curtis. And Jackie Curtis kept devising these plays for off-Broadway, and suddenly everyone would come. Famous stars would come. In fact, Robert De Niro's very first play ever was written by Jackie Curtis, the first thing he ever acted in. And what's fascinating about Holly is just that she survived, and she lived the most wild life of all of them, and she didn't die, and managed to at least live out her lifespan and see where it all went. And I have divergent feelings about how the early drags, what they were called, superstars, how they were being treated by Andy Warhol. Andy would get into a new modality of art, and the first thing he would do is find people who had zero chance of ever making it in the world, but because they were associated with Andy, they could do anything. And suddenly they were named. Suddenly things were happening for them. It was like a miracle. And so, but then Andy would get bored with them and kind of drop them. And at one point he said something kind of nasty. Someone asked him, he said, "Are you doing any more stuff?" And he said, No, I've moved from drag queens to real girls." And of course, from our perspective on the trans experience at this stage, where everything has gone, this is almost pre-trans. The very first book that even named transsexualism was written in 1966 by Harry Benjamin. And so when you think that these three were doing all their stuff in the late 60s, this was an era that's beyond trans invisibility. This is almost like the Stone Age of being trans. And here they were out there in New York, way, way, way. If they ever saw what was going on now with Drag Race and things like that, they would have think in a million years they couldn't imagine it. The only advantage that they had was that being trans was such an odd concept at the time that everybody simply accepted them, especially Candy, as a real woman because she was so beautiful. And she would go to openings at lovely gala events all over New York City and be accepted by everybody as just the Andy's date for the evening.
What do you think about what Sheila just said?
Yeah, we've had some talks among the cast and crew about the role of Andy in these three women's lives, and I think it is, you know, there's two sides to the coin. We wouldn't have this pocket of trans visibility that wouldn't otherwise exist if Andy hadn't given a platform to them, but I think what Sheila said is correct. Andy would get inspired by different people and different things, and maybe didn't reflect about what happened to those people when they were dropped later. And I think we can look back and say, you know, that wasn't very conscientious or kind behavior to sort of raise these people up to stardom who had zero other resources or opportunities, and then kind of drop them shortly after. So, you know, I think there is room for judgment with regards to that.
I mean, in a way, that's almost what Andy Warhol did with Michel Basquiat, too. So, Mickey, in your construction of the play, how did you work with the memory of these three people, and what are you trying to add to their stories that's new, or to your story of telling their story?
Yeah, I think I was really fortunate that there's a lot to draw from. Candy Darlene's journals and letters were published in the 90s. So you really get a peek into how she thought. She was a really philosophical person, but also very funny. There's Holly's memoir. There's an oral history about Jackie called Superstar in a House Dress that was really great. And what I found was, you know, they had a real tight bond with each other, but there were also rivalries, and they were pretty open about what they saw as each other's shortcomings. So that was kind of fun for drama. And they had a lot of ups and downs over, you know, the maybe the 5 or 6 year period when they were becoming known as actresses. And that kind of lends itself to sort of a classic showbiz tale of, you know, what's more important, friendships or fame. And I think that kind of created the spine of the story, looking at how each of them handled that. For me, I feel like we don't maybe necessarily think about trans history because we just aren't exposed to it that much. And so to be able to tell this sort of classic story about these three trans women who were sort of doing something that seems almost impossible. Like 50 years ago, there were still laws against impersonating women that they were all in jeopardy for every time they stepped out on the street, but they kind of pursued their dreams and made these lives happen. And I think it can stand almost as this sort of iconic history for trans women.
So Ruby, what do you bring to this as well? I mean, in your performance of Candy Darling, what are you bringing to the story of Candy that's maybe new or is unique to your story?
You know, I was really lucky to get cast and to work with this group of people in an organization where trans voices are part of the whole creation process. So this play represents kind of a chance to look back at a time when trans people weren't in control of their narrative. When, you know, we have these films by Andy Warhol, but we really haven't scratched the surface of who these people really are or what drove them and how their lives were really like. And so I think that informs kind of my approach to the role, like embracing that they were in imperfect circumstances, that they were imperfect people. But it's important to tell these stories and to involve trans people in the telling at every level.
Mickey, can you talk more about that? I mean, that's something that I know your productions are especially, you know, focused on, is making sure that the cast is mostly trans and queer, and that you're really affirming the fundamental dignity of trans voices. How are you doing that in this play?
Well, in this play, you know, everybody's a part of the queer community, and I think, you know, four or maybe five of the cast members, all of, either all or less, one less than all of the cast members identify as trans. The director, Rusty, really adopted this project after we had a reading last year, and, you know, they're non-binary, and it's been a great experience. They call it in theater the room, and the room has like a really lovely, lovely spirit, I think. Everyone is feeling free to kind of speak up, but also to just explore their creativity. Yeah, it's really fun to be working on a comedy like this and see everybody just playing around. And I know we're going to bring something great to an audience. I want to take a moment to just compliment Ruby. We had the first reading, and Ruby was amazing in My Perfectly Valid Objections, but this part is so different because Candy Darling just had lots of layers of performance to everything she did, I think maybe as kind of defense mechanisms, but also ways to gain entry to places. She would use this kind of creation of herself, and I was like, oh, you know, that's kind of tricky. I wonder what Ruby's going to do. And at the reading, I was just really blown away. I felt like Ruby just kind of either intuitively or just through her talent figured out how to portray that. And I think it'll be really fun for an audience to get to watch.
Yeah, I want to reflect that I have moments when I feel like I think Candy might have felt being excluded from those rooms for so long, where suddenly she's being appreciated for her talent, but she didn't have the opportunity to develop it. You mentioned My Perfectly Valid Objections was my first play in over a decade, and so here I am stepping back in it and getting to be part of a group effort to tell a really incredible tale.
So the venue, you're performing, you're doing the play this year over at Reed. Yeah. That's new for you, isn't it?
Yeah. It's so Rusty Tennant, the director, works at Reed and once a year gets access to the facilities there to produce a play as part of the Outright Festival. And they chose this play this year, which is an honor. And Yeah, it's really, it is new. It's a much bigger space. It's much newer than where my plays have been before, like a cafe, which was really cool. It was really fun to do it in a non-traditional space. But The other night I was sitting in rehearsal and I was like, wow, you know, it just sort of hit me. This is a very big space. And, you know, it's a much bigger stage. And so, yeah, it does feel like, you know, like it's nice to know that Rusty believes in the production and that people are going to get a chance to see maybe a deluxe version of one of my shows.
Great. Yeah. And it's a chance also to reach maybe a new audience too.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever is in that circle.
Yeah. Right.
In addition to all the other circles that follow you.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So that's so great. Oh, yeah.
Thanks, Emma.
So again, just tell, we're about midway through the show. So tell us again, where is the play going to be happening? When is it happening? All of that sort of thing.
Right. The play is Blonde on a Bum Trip, and it will be at the Performing Arts Building at Reed College, and it runs from May 16th to June 16th.
Great. And this is a comedy, right?
Yeah.
So that's, is it sort of a campy take on the story of these people or
what? Yeah. There's some camp. I mean, there's heart to it too, but yeah, it has some fun with, you know, the kind of ego and pettiness and envy that can come with pursuing success in the arts. And also, this was a really queer scene, so I think there's some kind of classic gay camp humor in it.
Mm-hmm. What is it like as a trans person dealing with camp?
It's, you know, I think I wasn't setting out to be like, this is going to be a campy play, but just reading about these folks and sort of immersing myself in their sense of humor, it just kind of came out that way. They had sort of a absurdist take on life sometimes, and their humor drifted that way. So I think it's fun. You know, I like sort of classical gay playwrights like Oscar Wilde or Joe Orton, who are really campy, and that's not usually the way my imagination works. So it was fun to sort of play in that area.
What about you, Rupi?
Yeah, I just want to call out the other people in the cast that Jackie and Holly are played by two great comic actors, emphasis on comic, Riley McCarthy and Juliet Milan. And then I don't want to undersell the other two actors who you won't see in any of the posters. But they are listed as playing multiple roles, and that's Cosmo Reynolds and Heath Hune. And that means that they play some of these celebrities that surrounded Holly, Jackie, and Candy, including Andy Warhol, Fran Lebowitz, Truman Capote. So I think that that'll produce a lot of laughs.
So this era that we're working with, you know, it's a different time from today. I mean, today is, we're living in a time where transgender people have so many more rights now than they did 50 years ago. But in some ways, we're also more visible and under attack. I mean, there's been this nationwide assault on trans kids, on, you know, folks just being able to use the bathroom, on the rights of on providers, people who provide healthcare for transgender, you know, other people. Where does this story of these three people fit into that broader narrative? And I'm going to ask Sheila if she'd like to step in and comment right here, because I know Sheila is very familiar with this time period. And then I'd like to go to you.
Well, when I got interested in doing my version of a play about Candy, I tuned in more to the tragic side of it all, and I also felt like I was trying to catch up with where the world had gone since then, and I was so delighted to see Candy finally getting some play, because I really thought Candy was massively, massively talented. And she actually, when Myra Breckinridge came out, which was a movie based on the Gore Vidal novel, and that was a big hit at the time, and the mere fact that it was trans at all meant a lot to a lot of people like me that were coming up. And so instead of taking Candy and letting a trans actress play the role, which would have been extraordinary, they chose Raquel Welch to play the part, and it broke Candy's heart. I honestly have a feeling that part of Candy's, I mean, certainly you can't program a cancer, and it's very, very doubtful that her early hormone usage had any effect on a cancer where it developed with Candy. I just think it was a lot of the people that knew Candy in her lifetime always commented on the idea that Candy almost wanted a tragic denouement because it was so 1930s, 1940s. Mm-hmm. The movies that she was like raised in, she would stay at home. She had very few friends growing up. And she would spend time in the New York era of the time. There was a thing called Million Dollar Movie, and they played the same movie for an entire week. And I lived in New York at the time. And what was interesting is that I could identify with that experience, because since it was the same movie again and again and again, she practically memorized the movie and then would act out the roles of the actresses that she most admired, especially Kim Novak. And she looked a lot like Kim Novak. So I'd be very interested to hear your guests comment on some of this backstory of the world that she came out of, the pretend world where her life and the celluloid life were almost one and the same.
Well, good question. Let's go to that, and then we'll come back to that other question.
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host of Transpositive, and I'm also the current president of the board of directors here at KABU. At KABU, we prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability to bring us together across distances and give us hope when we feel despair. Your friends at KABU want to remind you that generosity has the same power. Join thousands of KABU supporters from all around the world, and let's rally together to build stronger communities. If you can, just go to kboo.fm or text KBOO to this number 44321. And thanks so much for your support of KABU Community Radio.
It's very different. The play that Ruby and I did before, My Perfectly Invalid Objections, you could characterize as almost like 85 minutes of feminism, whereas like Candy, if you read her journals, there's this really long entry about how much she dislikes feminists and distrusts them. And Holly Woodlawn, when they did Women in Revolt, which was sort of a satire about women's lib, when she was asked, you know, about women's libbers, said, yeah, they're the ones who think women should have the right to vote. And I, you know, that's in the play, and because you want to be true to who they were. They weren't really on the vanguard of any politics, but, you know, their lives were inherently political. And the fact that we have this movie from 1973 about feminism that stars three trans women is kind of radical, even though that was the opposite of the intention of the director at the time, who thought that that was a really funny thing to do. So I think, you know, if there is politics to it, it's, you know, the fact that they existed and that this play can be documenting them refutes this idea that transgender people are a trend, and, you know, it's only like a social contagion that kids want to become trans. It's like, no, we've been here, we've been around, and their lives kind of prove that, even if they weren't working with Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson at the time to try to help the community through politics. You know, they were pursuing the avenue of the arts. I guess that's how I think about that within the frame of like trans issues and the trans movement.
What about you, Ruby?
Yeah, I think there's an echo in the play of the current kind of struggle to be seen for who we are and what we need. There's moments in the play where they experience kind of harassment, or the bare truth of what some people thought of them, that they kept them around because they were entertained by them, but they weren't interested in their lives. So I don't want people to leave our play saying, oh, it was so much worse back then. Look how many rights we have now, because in a lot of ways, this is our effort to say, we've always been here.
Yeah, I mean, we belong to the generation we belong to, but we're always transgender, or gender variant, or gender fluid, or two-spirit, or non-binary, whatever terms existed at the time. We were there in those spaces, mm-hmm. and we'll be there in the future, whatever comes.
Okay. Well, I believe that the intriguing thing about Candy and why she's an iconic figure is because Candy was starting to make it. At the time, Tennessee Williams had written a play called Small Craft Warnings, and a major role in that film, in that play, was Candy Darling, and she played it as a straight woman in the play, and this was unheard of. And this was another thing that, along with Women in Revolt, really was telling Candy, I've made it. It's going to happen for me. I'm going to be discovered. I'm going to get to live my dream. And then all of a sudden, the play kind of shut down. This was during a time of Tennessee Williams' own life when he was deeply into addictions and things. And so in spite of everything, everything just kind of fell apart. And then comes the cancer diagnosis. So I don't know if the play brought out some of those tragic elements, but the figure of Candy is not only iconic because she was a memorable personality under any circumstances, but because, again, she was at the prow of the ship, literally breaking into ground that had never been occupied even by most just gay or lesbian people at the time, let alone a trans person like her. And she was trans. There's no doubt in my mind that Candy wanted to live as a woman and be recognized as a woman and break into major roles. And when that didn't happen for her after getting just that close, it was heartbreaking. So I'd be very interested in what these two ladies have to say about that.
Yeah, I want to thank Sheila for bringing up Myra Breckinridge, because it's a plot point that we don't bring up in the play. After, you know, spending her whole childhood comparing herself to these stars of the silver screen, all these straight roles, she saw a chance at a film role about a trans woman. And there's record of all the letters she wrote to the studio saying, "I'm right here. You should pick me." And it's true. She went into deep depression. And I think that speaks to her experience of trying to be noticed outside of the scene where she was experiencing success and just getting no traction.
So earlier you mentioned, Mickey, you talked about how, I mean, just in case people didn't remember, Sylvia, you know, was around at this time. Stonewall had just happened. Mm-hmm. I mean, the movement for trans rights was being led by trans women of color. Mm-hmm. What role, if any, did trans women of color have in the scene around Andy Warhol's factory? Was there any acknowledgement of this history that had just happened and of, you know, this like incredible step forward that was being led by trans people?
From what I've read about the Warhol scene, they were pretty stridently apolitical. They all hated hippies. Not that hippies are, all activists are hippies, but they kind of positioned themselves against that current of the 60s that was maybe more earnest. He, in the 60s, was surrounded by people who saw drugs as kind of this countercultural statement and were really immersed in that kind of world. There was, I wish I could remember, I think the person's name might be Maria Montez. There was a drag queen who was in a few of his films pre the era that we're talking about now, who was a Latine person. But I don't think that was a political statement in any way. I think that was just, this person was part of the scene, and I don't know that much about her. But no, there wasn't really much intersection between the politics of the time and the Warhol scene, which I think can be sort of seen. The original title for Women in Revolt was PIGS, which was an acronym for Politically Involved Girls. they just had sort of the worst ideas about what that movement was about, and they thought it would be funny to satirize it. So yeah, that's my take on it.
What about you, Ruby? What's your take on that?
Yeah, and they chose to satirize the women's liberation movement using trans women because they thought the big joke was that these were men who wanted to be women. So they were really the butt of the joke without knowing it, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And I think some of them looked back on that role and said it was pretty humiliating.
Mm. Sheila, this is a great place for you to step in. Would you like to address this?
Oh, I had one more.
Okay. Hang on, Sheila, yeah. Just a minute. Ruby has one more comment, and then I'll ask you to speak.
And from what I've heard in the narratives of the time about where, you asked where was Sylvia, where was Marcia and all this, there was sometimes a delineation between transvestites, transsexuals, street queens, and people who were performers. And however fuzzy that line is, I think if there was a distinction, Candy would have, at some point, no matter what scene she came up through, decided she was probably too good for some people.
Yeah, Sheila, what are your thoughts about all this?
Well, I'm kind of being the historian tonight. Paul Morrissey was the director of Women in Revolt, and I think the early Warhol films were meant to draw in. They were meant to be splashy. They were meant to be pushing the limits, because he was also doing things like Chelsea Girls. He was doing all kinds of experimentation. It was very much a postmodern thing going on. And one of the things that I'd love to hear your guests comment on is the sheer talent of Candy. And one of her iconic lines was a line from Kim Novak about Jean Eagles, and she would always say this. She would say, "I don't need you. I don't need anybody. I'm Jean Eagles." And this was her kind of making fun of herself as she tried to break in and live out that whole Hollywood persona. And at the end of Women in Revolt, she's being interviewed, and it's probably the longest scene in the film. And she is this is where the line of a blonde on a bum trip is brought out, which was Candy's original line about herself when she was talking in an interview once with Jane Fonda and Andy. And what was funny about it is that it's Candy making fun of Candy, but being beautiful and fantastic at the same moment. But it also has a kind of a tragic edge to it, because in the end she's kind of pushed aside and all the scenery breaks down around. And be very interesting, I think, to draw people into seeing the play, to hear how the playwright has brought out other things in her play, and how this delicate balance between tragedy and comedy is handled in our lives and in our creative work. How certainly at her time there was no way to get into print without being sensational, but I'm wondering in this specific play how this balance between tragedy and comedy and leaving a message and creating bonding with Candy was handled in this particular play, which I think will draw in the audience. You can never know what an audience is going to walk out with, but I'm just wondering in the playwright's own mind what she was thinking and how she wanted to hit a balance between those two aspects of tragedy and comedy.
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, I think Candy was a really just really talented comedian. If you watch the films, she really jumps off the screen. And there's this funny story that didn't make it into the play, but she went to the premiere of Holly Woodlawn's film Scarecrow in a Garden of Cucumbers, and she had a bag of tomatoes, and someone asked her what they were for, and she said, "Just in case I need them to like throw at the screen," which I think sort of shows her wit. The tragedy, not to give away too much about the play, but I think it kind of, you know, mortality itself, she faced that at such a young age, and that causes anyone to reflect and kind of think about the values that they've lived by and the choices that they've made. And so there's some of that in the play. I don't think it discounts, you know, there was nothing wrong with Candy wanting to be successful and wanting her talent to be known. So it kind of shows two different sides of her life. And then I think the comedy, some of it just comes from how sort of absurd the world that they're in is. Like, they would make these films on almost no money, so they'd be filming in the director's house, or you know, there wouldn't be a script. They would just be wearing whatever they wore to the set that day. But then they're also getting reviewed in Newsweek magazine just because Andy Warhol was so famous. And so it's this real clash of worlds, this sort of very kind of dingy, scrappy underground that meets the kind of high culture of the time.
Do you have anything to add to that, Ruby?
Yeah, I'd say, to Candy's credit, she also went and visited Holly's cabaret. There was this point where they had this competing cabarets, and Candy's was unsuccessful, and it was kind of her last hurrah. But she made amends with Holly at the end, and that's part of what we portray. To the earlier question, I think part of the genius of Candy is she delivers her camp with such sincerity. And that's something that we're trying to stay true to, that if you break that, then you take the audience out of it as well. And I think that Candy was just in character to the bitter end, and it makes for a really bittersweet ending that I hope people will enjoy.
Well, we've just got maybe 4 or 5 minutes left, so I just want to make sure to wrap up by, first of all, telling us again, where can people go to see the play? When is it happening? If you could give us the details.
Sure. Blonde on a Bum Trip will run from May 16th to June 16th at the Performing Arts Building at Reed College. Shows will happen Thursday through Saturday nights at 7:30, and then on Sundays at 3? Oh my gosh. 3, okay. At 3. There'll be matinees at 3 in the afternoon. And tickets are pay what you will. Fuse Theater has a policy they call Gay AF, which stands for Give As You're Able Friends. So
I don't have to bleep that.
Right, yeah. No one turned away for lack of funds.
Sheila, do you have any last thoughts?
Okay. Well, I love the whole thing with Kim Novak, and I love the whole thing that I think the relationship to Andy Warhol is so key, because, as it was said, that without Andy, there would not have, even what Candy knew and did get in her life would never have happened. But I've always been very fascinated by Andy too, because Andy used other people as masks for the people that he could not be. He had this strange ability to almost draw people in, let them be themselves, and then live himself out through whatever they would say. And a classic example of this is he took Candy to an art gallery, and they said, "Well, what do you think of all of this that you're seeing tonight?" And Andy said, I don't know. What about you, Candy?" And then Candy, of course, is put right on the spot and has to say something about it. And she kind of looks around and has her little moment and just comes up with something out of almost nowhere. But this is the world that Candy comes out of. And I guess I'd love to hear our guest tonight to be able to say something about how straight culture, in a sense, uses trans people to define its own parameters and sense of self. Because the world that we're inhabiting now, and all these projections that are being placed upon the entire trans community, is also was happening even back then.
But I'm going to cut you off right there, Sheila. But I'm going to say that is a great question, and we will take that to the next time we do an interview, because unfortunately, we're out of time now. But it's just been so It's really been a pleasure talking with you, Mickey and Ruby. Your new play, Blonde on a Bum Trip, is going to be playing this month and early next month at Reed. And it's just been a real pleasure talking with you. Is there anything else you'd like to share before we go?
No. Thank you so much for having us. It's great to get to talk with you again. And yeah, I would just say, anybody listening, please invite everyone you know and ask them to invite everyone they know to Blonde on a Bum Trip.
Yeah, trans visibility is a buzzword right now, but this play is a real win for trans representation. So I hope all the trans people in town would come out and support us.
Great. Thanks so much for joining us today on Trans Positive.
Transgender people don't live here.
I've never met anyone who's transgender.
I swear I don't know someone who's transgender.
Transgender and non-binary people like me hear this all the time.
But according to the HRC Foundation, there are more than 2 million transgender people in the United States.
We live in every community across this country.
You might be surprised to hear that there are more transgender and non-binary people in the United States than there are
Starbucks, McDonald's, and Walmart locations combined.
In fact, if you put us all together,
there'd be more non-binary and transgender folks than the populations of DC,
or Nebraska,
or Maine,
or Idaho,
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the US.
So here are a few things to keep in mind.
You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors,
your coworkers,
your students,
your customers,
and even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing forward discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real.
Problems that don't actually exist.
But we do.
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 And we need your support.
Hi, this is Emma. I am a co-host of Trans Positive, and I'm also the
current president of the board of directors here at KABU. At KABU, we prove every day that people-powered radio has the ability to bring us together across distances and give us hope when we feel despair. Your friends at KABU want to remind you that generosity has the same power. Join thousands of KABU supporters from all around the world, and let's rally together to build stronger communities. If you can, just go to kboo.fm or text KBOO to this number 44321. And thanks so much for your support of KABU Community Radio. Bedroom surprise.
FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.